The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Welcome again to our weekly podcast. This week we're going on our travels on the trail of two of the authors who won Costa Awards last week. First we're heading to Africa to talk boarding schools of all things. That's the setting of Jason Wallace's Out of Shadows, which has won this year's prize for children's fiction.
I set Out of Shadows in a boarding school in Zimbabwe specifically because it's very close upbringing that I had at school, which was in a boarding school in Zimbabwe, really. There were a lot of exciting times and incidents at my school that I had, and I just wanted to bring that into a story, but fictionalise it into an exciting storyline as well, so that the background of my school is there. But, you know, it's not the story of my life, but that's why it's set in that particular environment.
We'll be phoning South Africa to ask a writer there what she thinks of that. Then we head further east to India to meet Kishwa Desai, who won the first novel award for Witness the Night. We talked to her in Delhi.
In Punjab, traditionally, it used to be through giving them opium when they were just born, through strangling them, through poisoning them, through putting them in little earthen pots and drowning them in milk, just like you would drown, I suppose, a kitten or something.
And it's back to Africa to pick up a rather special prize that dropped into our laps this week. An interview with Wole Soyinka.
Something in me is getting very weird, and that is the burden of repetition. That is possible in my own state. For someone to sit down and try and turn a townhouse meeting into his own thuggish platform.
Partnering me in the studio today is our book's website editor, Sarah Crown. And since we're talking schools, let's be transparent, Sarah. I confess I did go to boarding school. Did you?
No, I didn't. Which may mean that I like boarding school novels better than you did, possibly.
I guess it's not unusual for children's books to be set in boarding schools. Think Enid Blyton's Mallory Towers, think Hogwarts. But Jason Wallace's Out of Shadows is no Harry Potter jape. His boarding school is in Zimbabwe at the moment Mugabe comes to power. It's the story of a 13-year-old English boy negotiating an institution in which African pupils are technically equal, but the houses are still named after the heroes of colonial Rhodesia. Jason defended the way he used his own school experience in the novel.
When I first went there, it was a predominantly white Southern African school, 15% black pupils and 85% white. Majority of people lived in the cities, lived on farms, and obviously had to travel some distance to get to school. So once we were at school, that was it for most of the term. But it very, in terms of the actual characteristics of the people, all sorts really, but one overriding memory is that people at my school were all very decent, sort of open people. They were all very generous, all good fun to be with. Certainly the characters in the book are deliberately darker than they really were. No one in the book was at my school. Yes, there were a few characters who maybe took some of the bullying elements a little bit too far, but I think that happens anywhere in the world, so any school in the world really. It wasn't, you know, just my school. Generally speaking, it was a good fun place to be. It was hard at times because of the seniority that may have been there, but it just made you that much more determined to try and, you know, make it through and do all right. Certainly being in a boarding school gave claustrophobia to the story. Robert Jacklin is somebody who's gone to a new country, a new environment, a new culture. Everything about it is new, but what makes life for him even worse initially is that he's contained within this school. There's nowhere to escape. He can't just suddenly get through a school day and then go home and hide in his bedroom or talk to his parents or anything like that. He's basically in the school 24/7, and there's nothing that he can do about it other than try and work his way through. So he's given certain dilemmas, he's given certain choices in school, and it's interesting to see how he copes. It's not easy for him, and it's a good way of learning about life, I think, for him, generally speaking, of how to cope and how to solve issues when you've got no one around you to help, it's basically he's self-reliant and it's really to see how he copes and comes out of it.
This isn't the first successful book about life in boarding school to come out of Southern Africa recently. There's the Spud series by the South African writer John van der Riet, which has been made into a film and will shortly be reaching our screens. I met John in the small Cape town of Franschhoek last summer.
The private school system was inherited from England. The school I went to was Michael House, which is known as Little England on the Veld. And so a lot of the customs, I think, and the routines, etc., terminology of the school, I think, would be familiar to English people. And it's also really just a coming-of-age story about a young boy who goes there. He's underdeveloped. Everybody in his year is already well on the path to manhood, and he's still a little boy, and he's got a beautiful singing voice, which he's terribly ashamed of. And it's really about adolescence. It's a universal theme in many ways. Although he's got crazy parents, a senile gran, an alcoholic English teacher who becomes his unlikely mentor. I didn't want to create a Harry Potter type character who was wonderful and a genius, etc., etc. He's a flawed human being who comes from a very rather racist family. So he's suddenly in a multiracial school and he's trying to find his own way, I suppose.
John van der Riet there. Well, on the line now from her home in South Africa is another children's author who's also written about boarding school, Sally Ann Partridge. Hi, Sally Ann.
Hi there, Claire.
Are you a boarding school girl?
No, I went to an average public school in Cape Town. I haven't even set foot in a boarding school myself.
But nevertheless, your own first novel, The Goblet Club, was actually set in a boarding school, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. When I was about 16, one of my friends was sent to an all-boys boarding school in Villiersdorp, which, as I mentioned in the first night of my novel, is as far away from anywhere as anywhere could be. And during the holiday, he'd come back and tell me how horrible it was and all the terrible things that would happen to him there. And that story stuck with me, and then it all came flowing back when I started writing.
So tell us a little bit more about Southern African boarding schools. Presumably you don't know necessarily about Zimbabwean ones, although maybe they're similar in some ways.
I wouldn't imagine that there's much difference to the English or even the Zimbabwean counterparts. We have boarding schools here, like the one in Villiersdorp that I mentioned, and of course Michael House, where Spud was set. We also have a lot of private schools, like Bishop's in Cape Town, which is an all-boys school, and Rondebosch Girls, which is the female equivalent. Quite a few South Africans still go to boarding school. My cousin, in particular, went to an all-girls Catholic school, quite far from home. So, I mean, there are quite a few still around.
In the English boarding school novel, they're a sort of fantasy world often, aren't they? They're away from parents, which is one of the tropes of children's literature. We have Enid Blyton's Lashings of Ginger Beer tradition. That's what I like to call it. Now, Sarah, will you speak for the English tradition? Tell us what it's all about. Where does it go back to?
Yes, it's a very long and noble tradition, actually. Noble, I guess, depends on your perspective on boarding schools, probably. But certainly it goes back a very long way. The first boarding school novel, and we found out, in fact, mentioned on the podcast last week, was a novel by a woman called Sarah Fielding. That was written in the 1700s, and it was called A Governess. Actually, it was interesting in that that was set in a girls' school, and from there on in for the next few hundred years, they tended to be concentrated in boys' schools. Then we had Tom Brown's School Days, obviously would be the big famous one, the Molesworth books, and then we moved on into the 20th century, and it became more of a genre for girls, I think, with Mallory Towers. I grew up on Mallory Towers and St. Clair's, the two Enid Blyton ones, the Chalet School books. And then, obviously, now we've come all the way to Harry Potter, which is clearly the biggest proponent of boarding school literature these days. It's a huge deal.
One of the things about Harry Potter is it is not political, and both Spud and Out of Shadows are clearly political. Sally Ann, do you think that there is a different inflection inevitably in boarding school novels coming out of Africa?
Yes, definitely. I mean, apartheid was part of our history. So that's definitely going to be a central theme in many of our novels.
Tell us a little bit about Spud, because I don't think so many children will have read it here as have read it in South Africa.
Well, Spud is a very interesting novel, as it's one of those rare stories set at a particular time that resonates with a wide audience. But, the book is set in 1990 when apartheid has just ended and Nelson Mandela is about to be released from prison. That part of South Africa's history is seen through the perspective of a 13-year-old boy, which is quite refreshing in that it's not in a documentary style or it's not literary fiction, which I think makes it quite acceptable to a lot of younger readers. And the setting is also very important because instead of, you know, setting the book right in the thick of the action or reporting on it in almost, like I said, documentary style, it's almost at the background because you know, the book is actually about 13-year-olds Bud Milton starting boarding school for the first time, which is more important to him. It's also a classic boarding school story. Bud Milton has to adjust to his new environment. He has to try and fit in with the boys in his dorm room and make friends. Older readers love it because of the humor element, which is very dry and deadpan. The South African references also make it seem more like a memoir than a work of fiction. And many adults that have read the books have actually stated that the reason they enjoyed it so much was because it reminded them so much of their own school years.
So you're talking about white South Africans, are you? Or you're talking about moneyed South Africans?
A lot of the private schools now, they're multicultural. So maybe in the past they could have been seen as all white. But that's not really the case anymore.
I was very struck, Sarah, bring you back in now, by Jason saying that his school that he writes about could be any school in the world, and John saying that his books are about adolescence, full stop. Is this actually possible, that these institutions are interchangeable?
Absolutely. I think almost they're a means, a vehicle for authors to write about that state of adolescence that Sally-Anne was talking about in the Spud novels, the adapting to a new environment, making new friends. It's a form of coming-of-age novel, really. We had a blog last week on the site talking about the ongoing popularity of boarding school fiction, whether or not it's a genre that can carry on into the future. And one of the comments that I thought was absolutely spot on was by S.M. Pugh, who says that it's just a literary device to take children out of the orbit of their parents, because only then can they have real adventures. Why do you think there are so many literary orphans, which is the other literary device for doing the same thing? And I think that what boarding school novels have over the novels that employ the device of orphaning a child to allow him or her to have experiences on their own is that they offer that freedom away from parents, but they offer it in a situation that imposes order as well. So it's a kind of safe freedom. And I think that's why they appeal so strongly, because we have all of the freedom and excitement that we want, this sense of being away and alone and independent in a system that is rigorous and ordered, and you go to bed at a set time and you get up and you have your lessons.
I think that Jason might disagree with you about this. I've just been reading Out of Shadows, and at the end of the very second chapter it has one of the sort of great foreshadowing lines that children's literature goes in for, and it's if someone had told me then how badly I would actually come to let him down, this is a black boy, and the way in which I did it, I would never ever have believed him. So it's about cowardice and not safety. I mean, terrible things happen in Out of Shadows.
Well, of course, the great thing about any genre is that you can write the genre and then you can completely subvert it. So again, you could say that the point that he's making is much stronger, because he's making it against the backdrop of this very familiar genre that we all know about, where you go to your boarding school and you have the term and the bad girls or boys are punished and the good girls or boys are rewarded. And so by then sort of tripping us up, by lulling us into a false sense of security, and then completely going against, writing against the form that he's writing within, it's a much more powerful book because of it. And he's done very well there, I think.
Can I just bring Sally-Anne back into it? Sally-Anne, is it actually appropriate or valuable to tell the story of Southern African to children through basically colonial or post-colonial institutions like the boarding school?
Boarding schools are quite colonial, and I think they still do have quite an aura of elitism about them. So I think to tell the South African story, that would not be the correct way to do so, no.
Sally-Anne Partridge, thank you very much. Your books actually haven't come to the UK yet, have they?
No, not yet. They're going to hit America soon.
Very good.
But the UK, I think we might have to wait a little bit longer for that.
Well, we look forward to that. So, next to West Africa. The Nobel laureate Wally Soyinka is giving up his role as a political activist to spend more time with his writing. That's after decades of fighting the political establishment in his home country. He's bored of fighting the same old battles, but he does feel that Nigeria may be changing. He spoke to our Southern Africa correspondent, David Smith.
I see glimmerings of possibility of rescuing it from the brink. You have courageous people like, for instance, the chairman of Central Bank, who has pointed out, even though he didn't describe it as such, but I extrapolate. Now, one of the signs of a failed state is when a small bunch of people, quote-unquote, legitimately rob a nation of its revenues by 24% and feel good doing it, and abuse and insult the technocrat who can say that this cannot continue. The nation is going to collapse. And what you do is start abusing him, insulting him, telling him to apologize. It's when I see people like Shanusi and the principal stance they've taken that I retreat a little bit on describing Nigeria as a failed state. It's when I see, for instance, a belated but concerted effort now to stop kidnapping for ransom as a way of making it difficult for investors to come in, participants in development of any nature, even whether as tourists, to come in. And this has gone on for such a long time. During that period, you say, well, we're approaching a failed state. But now you see the beginnings of an understanding that this is part of the description of a failed state. Corruption, mammoth corruption, where a head of state uses the instrumentation of corruption to blackmail. In other words, encourages corruption. Because you know how corrupt governors, how corrupt senators, and so on and so forth. You rig the elections into office because that's the kind of people you want to deal with. A former policeman in the House of Representatives, or was the Senate, got up and said, I look around me. And anybody who challenges me, I will name them. I can point out those whom I have prosecuted and jailed for crimes, corrupt crimes, for extortion, in some cases for murder. Some of them are here as representatives of the people. But as I said, at this moment, there are glimmerings that we might just retreat from the brink. But by the time the elections take place, it will be the burden of other people. If they miss their chance, they will not complain that Wole Soyinka didn't offer a small wedge inside this seething mass of corruption, of degradation of society, and so on. Now, just leave me alone.
Why are you retiring from public life?
I'm getting a little bit bored with the Sisyphean struggle. The same cycle round and round. I'm not exhausted. I can drop down dead tomorrow. That's irrelevant. I won't be around to witness the event. But at the moment, I do not feel I'm devoid of energy. My energy is diminished, either mentally or physically. No. But something in me is getting very weary. And that is the burden of repetition. That is possible in my own state. For someone to sit down and try and turn a townhouse meeting into his own thuggish platform. It's over 50 years now. I've been marching. I know the number of times I've been tear gassed. And of course, I've gone through trials and imprisonment without trial and so on and so forth. I don't mind all of that. Mandela spent how many years? One entire generation of his life in jail. So I don't grudge any of that. But if I feel inside me that I'm getting bored, when you get bored on a subject, on a theme, or an endeavor, you become less creative. And I don't want that to happen to me.
Has it been difficult to balance being both an activist and a writer at the same time? Because many people tend to be one or the other.
No. I've had no problem at all. One, in fact, inspires the other. The more you write, and by creative also, I include political creativity, which is, also an act of creativity. Even governance is a kind of... A state like this is a tabula rasa in which to write. It's a canvas in which to paint,
Will you continue to write?
Oh, yes, I'm continuing to write even as we speak. But don't ask me what I'm writing because I never answer that question.
I know, people always ask that question.
Wole Soyinka there. No doubt at least some of those thieving leaders he's talking about went to boarding school. And now we go to India, where we met up with the novelist Kishwar Desai. She's a former journalist and social campaigner with homes in both India and the UK. Her husband, Lord Desai, is the economist and Labour peer. Her first novel, Witness the Night, takes on the tricky subject of gendercide. That's when girls or women are killed for various reasons. She's written both non-fiction and journalism, so I suppose she can take the inevitable flak she's been receiving in India. Our Delhi correspondent, Jason Burke, asked her why she chose such a controversial subject.
Because I grew up in Punjab and in Haryana, my father was in the police and we used to be transferred around a lot. So I think one must have subconsciously kind of absorbed a lot of the culture and the way people live and their attitudes towards women. I was fortunate because I grew up in a much more liberal household, and therefore I could do what I liked and so on, even in choice of career, which I wanted to do. So straight after college, I started working. I went into television fairly early, before most women were working in television, actually. There wasn't such a, you know, there's absolutely a cloudburst, as it were, of women working in television now. But those days, there weren't very many. There weren't very many opportunities either. But I did do, at that time, work as a journalist in television. Then I did, but I carried on writing side by side. And I had also been a channel head in the course of my career, which is of a channel that was a Punjabi channel. It was based in Punjab. And so as a result of which, I did get a lot of people coming to my office with stories, sometimes of the kind that I have put into my book now. And I remember this was about 10 years ago. This had a really, I think, a huge impact on me, was a woman who came to my office for a chat show. And we were just discussing her life. And she said that how when she had, she remembered being told when she was a little girl that actually she shouldn't have been around at all because her parents had tried to give her opium when she was a baby and tried to kill her because she was a baby girl and they didn't want a baby girl in the family. And I think that sort of shocked me completely because here was this grown-up woman telling me this, and I kept thinking how horrible her life must have been to sort of look across the table or the room to her mother and see not her mother, somebody who cared for her, but really an assassin who probably wanted to get rid of her quite early. So I thought that was a very traumatic way for a lot of young girls in India. And now, you know, as I researched it, I found that this wasn't just a Punjabi story. This was happening in Haryana. It was happening in Rajasthan. It was happening even in Tamil Nadu. And now research shows that it is also happening in Maharashtra, that people are trying to get rid of their baby girls in the most gruesome ways possible. In Punjab, traditionally, it used to be through giving them opium when they were just born, through strangling them, through poisoning them, through putting them in little earthen pots and drowning them in milk, just like you would drown, I suppose, a kitten or something. Sometimes they would be just thrown away onto the streets and left to starve. And, you know, and just cry themselves to death. They would not be fed. So I thought this is horrible. And then, of course, what was it doing to our gender ratio in Punjab? Some of the most horribly skewed gender ratios in this country are coming out of some of the most prosperous states, like Punjab, like Haryana, like Maharashtra, you know, sometimes the most elite colonies that have it. And I think that was what I wanted to do. I didn't want to look at the poor. I wanted to look at, does this happen in the richer classes as well? And this is what emerged then, that it was also something which was not just because you're poor and you want another boy, sort of another pair of working hands. But this was also happening more and more with the rich. And they were becoming much more selective about who they wanted. And they normally just wanted a boy. They wouldn't want, because, you know, it was, if you were rich, you were worried about inheritance. You were worried about that the girl would get married and go away and probably take away your wealth. And she was looked upon as a terrible investment. If you had a lot of land, the birth of a baby girl meant that there would be a division of your property and things like that. And so it was something which I think we needed to look at. So somewhere the story began to form in my mind maybe about 10 years ago.
Why did you choose fiction to write about it? Why not write, you're a former journalist, why not write a gritty, investigative piece of reportage? Why choose fiction?
You know, I think I first wrote my first story on female feticide about 20 years ago. And I sort of stumbled upon it the other day when I was sort of, you know, going through my papers. And I was just horrified. Here was I, this journalist, just wandered into, in fact, a Murray Stopes clinic, which is meant for, you know, helping women to get abortions of unwanted children. What it was being used for mostly in those days was to get rid of unwanted baby girls. And I think I kind of just stumbled upon the story because I went there to do something else, and then I found this very venerable-looking elderly gentleman who had brought his very young daughter-in-law for first a scan, an ultrasound scan, and then possibly an abortion, you know, so that it was very much confirmed that. And I think sitting around that, when I was in that waiting room and talking to the women, I found a lot of them had come exactly for that. And what I think shocked me even more at that time was when I met the doctor, who was a female gynecologist, and she was so sympathetic towards these girls. It was a very confusing picture because, you know, she felt that if she did not help these girls get rid of these unwanted, as it were, in quotes, baby girls, they would be treated very horribly when they were taken back to their village or their town, and they could sometimes be ill-treated. The baby girls would be left to starve, to die. So she actually thought, and believe me, this is still happening today, because a friend of mine who's a gynecologist, I was talking to her the other day, and she repeated to me exactly what this lady had told me 20 years ago. So things have not really changed. So I think I was horrified with that, and I realized that if you do nonfiction, most people just see it as a headline in a newspaper, and that's the end of the story. If you write it as fiction, you connect with the emotions. You make people actually get into the head of perhaps a young girl who may not be wanted, of perhaps people who actually want to get rid of her. You understand their motivations. Maybe you get upset. Maybe you get angry. The story will travel. I mean, these were really my thoughts when I wrote it. But I really didn't expect this reaction. I thought maybe a few people would read it and perhaps they would get angry like I was angry. I hadn't expected that it would reach where it has today.
It's not just fiction. It's a thriller, isn't it? It's a detective story. Although the detective is Simran, who's an activist, a social worker, 45, single, having an affair with a married man to the horror of her mother, who keeps telling her when she's going to provide a grandchild, whiskey drinking, cigarette smoking. She's the detective, or she's the agent through which the plot is unravelled. Was that? Do you like the detective stories? Is that did you read lots of them, or where did it come from? Was it the journalist in you? You're looking to make Simran a journalist would have been too obvious. Why the thriller and why Simran?
That was the way the story sort of formed itself. I don't think I actually sat and thought about it. I know it sounds stupid, but it was almost an instinctive way of writing. I'll tell you why, but before that, let me just state that even when I did the story, I had no idea that I was writing crime fiction. I don't actually read a lot of crime fiction, to be quite honest. I read a lot of novels, you know, which are written in much more, you know, spread out, and that tight structure of the crime novel is something I was unfamiliar with. I was just telling a story. At that point, I had no clue which genre I was writing in. And for Simran to be this detective type of social worker, I think I was, one thing I wanted to do was to contrast, because Durga, who is actually the girl who's accused of the crime, and because she, I felt, was somebody who would have grown up in this very oppressed and repressed kind of rich household, but, you know, somebody who was told what to do, what not to do, and things like that. I didn't want it to become another victim story coming out of India, you know, where women are victimized all the time. I also wanted to give a voice to the kind of woman I think is not seen in Indian literature enough, who is stroppy, who is sometimes even insensitive, who is outspoken, who is just all there in your face, who has an opinion about everything. And I thought that it would be interesting to have such a character in the book, because I think that is the other kind of gendercide which is happening in India, is that you see only a certain kind of woman represented in Indian cinema, in Indian music, in Indian dance, in Indian literature, and she's usually very beautiful, she's very sweet, she's, You can see the space even for struppy, outspoken Indian women going out, except for very recently we've seen some of them. But for a long time, we only saw these very pretty, very cute, sweet little girls who used to appear either in Indian literature or in on screen. So I think this actually, the genesis of this was not as a novel anyway. It was meant to be a film. This book was originally meant to be a film. But when I sat down to write it, I said, let me just tell the story and then I'll see what happens. But the moment I sat down, it just overpowered me. I think the story took over. That was the only way I can put it. And I just had to write it. It was like one mad, obsessive month in Goa, where I just couldn't get up from my table till I had finished writing the story. It was crazy.
You wrote in 30 days or four or five weeks.
Yeah, it was a frenzy. I would just get up in the morning and, you know, I just have short breaks for meals. Meghnath was there. He was my husband. He was writing his own book. And he was sitting at one end of the house and I was sitting at the other end, and we would just meet for meals and we'd rush back to our tables and start writing again. It was just a frenzy of writing, really. But I think it was only because I was so angry. When I started writing, I think the anger took over. I was furious about what was happening to women in India. I was furious about the way women are treated. And I think I was just so angry I couldn't stop. Probably the style of writing may seem a little peculiar, because these days we are so used to creative writing schools and, you know, people tell you have to create a plot and then you have to do this. And no doubt I will do that for my future books, but I'm sure. But for this one, what had happened was there is a very famous Urdu short story writer, you know, called Saadat Hasan Manto, of whom I'm a huge admirer, a huge fan. And this was the way he used to actually write his stories. And I somehow felt I wanted to know whether it could actually be done at one level, you know, because he would actually just sit down and, you know, it would all just flow out. And that was the way it would come. It was complete within itself. Probably it's a one-off, I'm not sure. But I'm just, for me at least, but I was just experimenting also with the style of writing. People have told me not to say this, because they said the moment I say this, I devalue what I've done, because I'm trying to sort of bring in a different style of writing which is not appreciated anymore, you know?
But, in what sense?
Because it's more spontaneous. It's not, you know, unless you really thought about it, unless you slogged up over it. People did tell me that. They said you should say 5 years. It took you 5 years to write this book, or three, because then people will respect it. But if you tell them you're just in a month, they're going to say, no, this is simply not good enough. And, you know, and there were big holes in it and your characters and this and that and the other.
Kishwa Desai there talking to Jason Burke. I can see Sarah sitting with tears in her eyes. It's a very tough subject, isn't it, for a genre novel particularly?
It is, but then I think that one of the interesting things that's happening to genre, or maybe actually I should rephrase that and say that because of the shift in our perceptions of genre novels that's taking place at the minute, we see a lot more genre novels going into society and looking at society's problems. And you only have to look actually at the serialisation of Michael Dibden's Aurelio Zen novels, which is on Sunday nights at the minute on the BBC. And that's all about, you know, corruption in Italian society and the sort of different layers of society in which that's happening, to see that, that crime is a great way into a lot of the difficult things that we have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. For some of us, it's all about Rufus Sewell, of course, but we won't go into that. So what else now have we got to look forward to next week on the website and in the various supplements of The Guardian and Observer?
Lots to look forward to this week. In Guardian Saturday Review, we have Laura Miller talking about the increasing prevalence of the internet in the novel. In The Observer, we have Eric Hobsbawm talking to the rather younger historian and MP Tristram Hunt about Marxism and history. And on the website, going back to Michael Dibden again, we have an exclusive interview with Michael Dibden. I know most of you...
He's dead, isn't he?
Yes, we know that he died a couple of years ago, but he recorded an interview with his publisher about the Zen novels in 2003, so you can come and see that online. And we also have a really lovely top 10 of Edmund White's New York novels.
Uh-huh. And in next week's podcast, we'll be finding out which of the four Costa category winners is the book of the year. Good luck to both Jason Wallace and Kishwa Desai. We'll also be out and about in the British Isles, tramping the Suffolk coast in the footsteps of W.G. Sebald, and venturing into the Scottish hills to a new museum devoted to Robert Burns. From Sarah and me and our producer Tim Mabey, for this week then, Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.